This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Fireworks, cookouts, parades, flags, waving, bright displays of red, white, and blue, bunting. Tomorrow, our country celebrates its independence with all the traditional July 4th festivities. And today, we take a look at films with patriotic themes. It's time for Movies on the Radio with film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Hello, Marcia.
Hello.
Let's start with a classic. Several listeners, we asked, of course, as we do every month, for listeners to chime in and tell us what they like and don't like. A lot of listeners loved Yankee Doodle Dandy. Marcia, tell 1942 film, right?
Yeah, this is a Warner Brothers film directed by Michael Curtiz, and it's one of my favorite kind of unabashed patriotic American films. It's a biopic of George M. Cohan, who's the composer, songwriter, singer-dancer, who wrote such songs as Over There, You're a Grand Old Flag. So this is a major producer of Americana. And Cohan is played by James Cagney, who had in the 1930s played gangsters and kind of tough guys. And here he gets to be this American hero who sings and dances. And I think one of the interesting things about this film is that Warner Brothers began working on this in early 1941, but shooting began just a few days before Pearl Harbor. So it just so happened that Pearl Harbor happens, we get involved in the war, and it's a very kind of fortunate coincidence for Warner Brothers that they were making such a patriotic film. And so this is George M. Cohan, Jimmy Cagney, singing the titular song.
I'm the kid that's all the candy. I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. I'm glad I am.
So Uncle Sam.
I'm a real life Yankee Doodle. Made my name and fame and boodle just as Mr. Doodle did by riding on a pony. I love to listen to the Dixie strain. I long to see the girl I left behind me. That ain't a Josh. She's a Yankee, by gosh.
Oh, say, can you see?
About a Yankee, that's
all for me. James Cagney, Yankee Doodle Dandy. Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, Marcia. Laura, when we think about this is a film that was not made for the war effort because the war hadn't started yet, and yet it was probably a film of its time. So when we talk about a patriotic film, I mean, what is it that we're talking about?
Well, Yankee Doodle Dandy in particular is nostalgia for the previous war, World War I, and it's kind of ironic in a way, the production history, because throughout the late 1930s and very early 1940s, Hollywood had kind of been bending over backwards not to offend their markets in Germany and not say anything bad about the Nazis because they didn't want to make trouble where they felt it wasn't necessary. So being nostalgic for World War I was perhaps a much more safe way to sort of, for example, support Britain in their war effort.
But this is also dressed up in so much just kind of love for America, as you could tell even just from that short clip, that in some ways I think it almost transcends the overtly political kind of war aspect too, because certainly leading up to World War II, meant it was very unpopular to be advocating to intervene in this war because of the experiences of World War I. But obviously after Pearl Harbor, that changes completely overnight. So this was really a right time, right place for this message. And it ended up being, I think, Warner Brothers' biggest grossing film up to that date. And, you know, Cagney wins an Oscar and it's this great performance. And it's all tied into this idea of a different kind of patriotism, in this case, the creation of pop culture through the Cohan songs, that is as important as, you know, being on the battlefield.
But an unabashed patriotism, yep, that is certainly something that we're going to see in the 1940s, not so much in the 1970s. And yet, because it was the bicentennial year, the film based on the stage version of 1776 was very popular. And it was one of the films that many of our listeners said was an important patriotic film for them.
My name is Robert Leverett. I live in Hillsborough, North Carolina, and my favorite patriotic movie is the musical 1776. The reason why it's my favorite patriotic movie is it is somewhat of a family tradition to view the movie around July 4th. We first saw the movie when we were little, and now my kids like to sit down and watch it as well. Just seeing the founding fathers being regular human beings and doing what what they had to do to get this country started is probably and most profoundly the reason why this is my favorite patriotic movie.
For 10 years, King George and his parliament have gull-cullied and diddled these colonies with their illegal taxes, stamp acts, Townsend acts, sugar acts, tea acts. And when we dared stand up like men, they have stopped our trade, seized our ships, blockaded our ports, burned our towns, and spilled our blood. And still, this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are you waiting for? Thomas, for God's sake, listen to me.
Well, we're waiting for that song, of course.
This is a strange, strange way to approach American history in some ways. And yet, obviously, as the listener points out, it really kind of resonated with him and his family. And it is, you know, I mean, it's telling the story of Adams and Washington and Franklin and these kind of historical things, but it's interweaving it with song. I mean, in some ways, what's more American than doing that?
Well, fetishizing the Founding Fathers is an important part of American patriotism. And actually, for another sort of backdoor look at it, I've really been enjoying Sleepy Hollow, which is this totally trashy TV series, because they look back on the Revolutionary War. You know, Ichabod Crane checks out at a grocery store, a former Revolutionary War, 8% tax. You know, my God, we started a revolution for 0.5%, you know. So looking back at through these different lenses at this seminal founding is very interesting.
Well, and it's interesting, too, to think about it in the context of the 70s, which obviously with Vietnam, and we're in a much more critical time period in terms of not just supporting the war that our nation has involved us in. And yet, looking back to the Founding Fathers, you can kind of be uncritical, right? You don't have to take a kind of political stance because you're applauding something nostalgic and something from history, as opposed to dealing with the really kind of complicated and morally fraught situation that your country is actually in.
And it was a feature of that period of time and in that era of protest to try to claim the Founding Fathers. There was a war
Doesn't everyone claim,
and that's interesting to me that we don't see that anymore, that nobody is trying. The Tea Party can have the Tea Party, and you don't see the left trying to say, no, it's not like Martí in Cuba, where both sides were trying to claim this figure for their own. Certainly in the 70s, there was this sense that independence and liberty and freedom is the thing that the left wants, and the thing, and you know, no taxes is the thing the right wants. Mm-hmm. That, by the way, the taxes went to pay for all the freedom that they got, and the British were just asking for a little bit of recompense for having freed you from all this stuff. And what they said was, I don't want to pay for it. I want the. Anyway, that's a couple of hundred years old, but it is interesting that that was the struggle back then. Whose patriots are these, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Whose founding fathers are these?
Right, absolutely. And I think whenever you have a film, I mean, I think that Sergeant York, for example, which is a film that looks back to the First World War, you know, not unlike in some ways Yankee Doodle Dandy, except it is so incredibly different because this is reclaiming this kind of real World War One hero played by Gary Cooper in the film, Alvin York from Tennessee. And this film was released prior to America's involvement in World War II. And I think it's necessarily the case that when you're talking about patriotic films, you end up talking about war films a good deal, because that's when certainly the big guns of propaganda come out and you are trying to rouse a nation to support a particular military involvement. But York is an interesting case because he was a conscientious objector for religious reasons, and he became this war hero who wins this Congressional Medal of Honor. And in the context of World War II and the people who did not want to get involved prior to Pearl Harbor, and York himself was campaigning against it, then you have this film where you have this guy kind of – he's kind of like the proto-Forrest Gump, actually, in terms of the way he stumbles into this heroism. And so I would beg listeners to please forgive Gary Cooper for his terrible attempt at a Southern accent.
Well, that's quite a word, freedom. I think that's what he wanted. I think that's what sent Boone into your Tennessee country.
Is that what this yearbook's about?
Yep. That's the story of a whole people's struggle for freedom. From the very beginning until now. But we're still struggling. It's quite a story, York. How they all got together and set up a government whereby all men were pledged to defend the rights of each man
and each man to defend the rights of all men. We call it a government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Well, I never knowed it was all written down.
You're a religious man, York.
Yes, sir.
You want to worship God in your own way.
Yes, sir.
You're a farmer.
Yes, sir.
You want to plow your fields as you see fit and raise your family according to your own lights. And that's your heritage. And mine, every American's. But the cost of that heritage is high. Sometimes it takes all we have to preserve it, even our lives. How are you going to answer that, York?
There we go. Movies on the radio.
Yeah. So what happens after this is that Gary Cooper spends a weekend reading the Bible and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights alongside each other until he has this kind of conversion happen. And he decides, yes, there's a reason to fight for. And you heard that kind of appeal to personal freedom. And this is pretty overt war propaganda. But I think it's told in a really interesting way in terms of like kind of rural religious Southern boy, you know, getting behind his nation despite the fact that he just really wants to live his own life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for a lot of the films that we're going to be talking about, there's this tension between war films and anti-war films and whether you can be an anti-war patriot or not. It's something that I think this country has gone back to over and over again.
Tell you what, we'll take a break right here, and we will explore that when we return with Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. It's Movies on the Radio. We're talking about patriotic films on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about patriotic movies with film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. You know, sometimes the definition of patriotism expands beyond our traditional concepts of blind loyalty. And you were talking about that just before the break, Laura. There comes a point in sort of American pop culture when patriotism is about being critical of the culture, right?
Absolutely. And when this topic was first proposed, it's these movies of protest that first came to mind as patriotic films.
Well, one listener called in and really loves the film The Front. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Mary Baggett. I'm from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I think The Front might be considered a patriotic movie. It tells about an important event in our history, which was the McCarthy era. And a lot of people were more or less being persecuted by the House Un-Americans Activity Committee. One of the ways that this film makes a big impact about that is that a number of people who were involved in the making of the film were actually blacklisted.
Mr. Prince, do you happen to know an Alfred Miller?
Who?
Alfred Miller.
Why?
If you just tell the committee.
So, I can't know why?
Mr. Prince, you don't have to worry. Anyone that comes here and tells the truth has got nothing to worry about.
Which Alfred Miller is it?
Do you know Alfred Miller, the writer?
When you say no, I mean, what, can you ever really know a person? I think, you know, I grew up with an Alfred Miller, but do I know him? Do I know him? Can you know, in a biblical sense, know him? Am I right?
Would that be the same Alfred Miller you met with several times in Hammer's Dairy Restaurant?
Who says I did?
Is it or is it not true?
No, I asked you first.
Is it true?
I don't understand. Is anybody accusing me of anything?
If you would answer the question.
But which question? You ask one question and then I answer that question and then you're...
Do you know Alfred Miller?
You already asked that question.
How's that for patriotic?
Yeah, well, I mean, in case you couldn't tell, that's Woody Allen in that role. And so, I mean, this is an interesting film. When it came out, actually, a lot of people criticized it for not being serious enough, taking a comedic approach that was actually shortchanging the seriousness of the blacklist, which absolutely ruined people's lives by, whether they were communists or just, left wing or really just got kind of named by someone, lost
their... Or if they named names themselves.
Right. And lost their ability to make a livelihood in Hollywood. But I think what this is actually a Martin Ritt film, not a Woody Allen film, but I think what Ritt is doing is really kind of interesting because he's using a kind of comedic looking back at this time period to point out through humor. I mean, humor is a hard way to get at a patriotic theme. And I think, I mean, frankly, my personal opinion is that the front is a pretty brilliant, attack on those kind of core conservative ideas about naming names. And by sending it up, I think it makes a really valid point about the way hysteria has built in this country.
It's the proto-Colbert Report.
Yes, indeed. And we had just fought a great war against fascism, and then almost immediately we had this homegrown fascist who, although certainly did not put people in internment camps, physically did, you know, as far as their careers and livelihood, as you said. And it's still a topic that in many ways has not been dealt with very extensively. And I actually got in a little hot water at the museum. I wrote the phrase commie witch hunt in one of my descriptions, and my editor says, you can't use that. It's like, do we still have, you know, admirers of Senator McCarthy? You know,
Yeah. Well, and this is a film that could not have been made, you know, in the late 1940s, early 1950s.
Or 60s. Because the blacklist was not broken until
the
70s. Spartacus.
Yeah. So in fact, you know, this, you know, even though it seems like it's so distanced from its subject, it's really not.
Well, and it was that fundamental question. Again, that tension more in the 60s and 70s, I think, than I feel now between what is it we're doing? Are we defending the nation? So should we stand behind, right or wrong, the nation that our forefathers wrought? Or do we stand behind the sort of overarching the impetus behind that movement? The right to rebel, the right to overturn the system when it's not working for us.
Right.
That became the tension.
And who gets to define who a patriot is?
Right. And then I think the idea of freedom of speech and ability to protest, I mean, that is a really central core of one kind of strain of patriotic film that that is, I think, easier to get away with when you make it not during wartime, right? Because those are the times where you can have a little bit of a critical distance.
Or make it a period piece of any kind so you don't seem to be addressing contemporary issues.
Right.
All the President's Men, on the other hand, did not allow a decent interval between the making of the film and the making of history.
My name is Richard Evans. I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina. One of my favorite patriotic movies is All the President's Men. I liked it because it showed that two well-meaning, non-politically important men could keep the political leadership of the country from corrupting the political process.
It was a Haldeman operation. The whole business was run by Haldeman, the money, everything. It won't be easy getting at him. He was insulated. You'll have to find out how. Mitchell started doing covert stuff before anyone else. The list is longer than anyone can imagine. It involves the entire U.S. intelligence community, FBI, CIA, Justice. It's incredible. Cover-up had little to do with Watergate. It was mainly to protect the covert operations. It leads everywhere. Get out your notebook. There's more. Your lives are in danger.
I'm glad that's all behind us.
it's a fairy tale with a happy ending, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the film that launched 1,000 journalists, too, right? It became this very romantic idea of what you could do and that you could, through the power of the press, change the shape of your government and create a more democratic, more perfect nation.
And I still feel that way. It's like every time they fire a reporter on the News and Observer, you know, I feel less safe as a citizen of the United States.
Well, I think we've certainly seen, in the past decade, the importance of journalists working inside and outside of conventional systems. And that's the legacy of Watergate.
Well, it is, but the fairy tale, I think, is something I want to examine. That was a very popular film. It was a great way to tell the story that had a heroic, happy ending. And that's really what we thought. Oh, glad that's over.
Right.
Well, what we really didn't do was critically evaluate that security apparatus that remained in power, that remains in power today, and as we can see through the NSA, still does this stuff to us. So we never really went deeper and said to ourselves, it's nice that we caught that guy. But I wonder if we've really dismantled the apparatus, and we sort of didn't ask that question because we were so happy with the fairy tale.
Right. We felt that we had all learned our lesson about the abuses of power, and so we don't have to worry about it anymore.
That's the thing that Hollywood does the best, though,
exactly.
Right? Because because you can personalize it. It's about a person. It's about an individual. It's not about a system. Hollywood's pretty bad at reflecting systems, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look even at the number of films we've talked about that are biopics, and it's much easier to tell that story through a real historical figure and, you know, create a very comfortable narrative that has, you know, this arc that you want to tell than to tackle something like an ideology or a political system.
And to identify with Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman instead of whichever actor is impersonating Richard Nixon.
Right.
Yeah, and it wasn't even about, I mean, so there's Nixon, and you can start throwing rocks at him, but there's a whole lot of deep gunk that is more systemic. So he could get at something like this with a film like Independence Day, for instance.
In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Mankind, that word should have new meaning for all of us today. We can't be consumed by our petty differences anymore. We will be united in our common interest. Perhaps it's fate that today is the 4th of July, and you will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
Woo! And there's that sappy music, like behind that Sergeant York clip, too. Yeah. It seems to also be a part of
and the pleas for fighting for freedom.
Yes, this is like the first of the patriapocalyptic movies, right? Where, you know, the White House is targeted by an alien force, and, you know, it's now zombies and vampires and plagues and alien, all of these things which threaten our nation the way Adolf Hitler once did, and so that we can bring out the best in ourselves to defeat whoever the enemy might be.
Well, what's interesting to me about this film and the ones that come after it is it's not just the nation anymore. And you hear that in that speech by Bill Pullman, the president, which is, this is aliens. We're defending the world. And we get to have this fantasy that in this kind of globalized world that we can still be the leading, you know, force saving the world. We can all come together as American, sort of. But I mean, you know, that scene, you know, it ends up being you're collaborating with the Middle East and with Russia and all of these different countries because you have this common cause, the aliens, which projecting outwards.
The common cause. This is my favorite theme in all patriotic movies because people tend to notice that, I love the war because we put all our differences aside and we had a common enemy. And you hear this theme over and over again. So what it does is it kind of allows us the luxury of this sort of pathological ability to side uncritically with a group of people who may or may not be right or who may or may not be doing the right thing. I'm going to put my judgment in a blind trust until this whole thing is over. So if we're all together, if the whole earth is together on the aliens are the enemy, now we can redeem this otherwise questionable quality of not being able to criticize.
And for a long time, the Cold War made it really easy for the Russians to be the other that we were always fighting against. And after, the fall of the Soviet Empire, Hollywood really cast around, for their, Euro trash, slash mythical middle. You know, they was. It's very hard to find that villain that will unite all of us so that we can forget our differences.
Yeah, I mean, if it was not the kind of Soviet enemy, which was so, you know, kind of James Bond easy to do, I think since World War II, we haven't had a war that we've felt good as a nation all rallying behind. So I think having these fantasy wars like with aliens kind of substitutes for those real war stories that we can't tell the same way anymore.
Particularly if we can bring the whole world together around it, again, redeeming this kind of this sort of critical judgment. Well, the Vietnam War was one of the wars that we found most difficult, I think it's fair to say, to reflect in the movies. We did have a number of folks who talked about films they liked. We also asked for films you didn't like, patriotic films you didn't like, and here's what one listener called in to say.
I'm James Phillips from Durham, North Carolina, and my least favorite patriotic movie is Saving Private Ryan because the melodramatic story that ends the film does not justify the hour of intense violence that begins the film.
What the hell do we do now, sir?
So, I mean, this is a classic Steven Spielberg. This is a classic World War II film, ordinary men banding together for the common justifiable cause. That landing on the beach scene that I believe we were hearing in a clip from, I mean, it strives to be intensely realist and intensely violent and using all of the state-of-the-art technology to bring us on that beach, and I think it achieves it really wonderfully. But, I mean, I do agree with the listener that this is absolutely a melodrama. But, you know, so many war films are melodramas. It's just between men in the trenches. And this one has a particularly, you know, kind of melodramatic arc with, you know, kind of finding this person.
Well, this begins what's probably going to be the last wave of World War II nostalgia, because Steven Spielberg was in particular motivated by his father and what is now suddenly being called the greatest generation. I don't know exactly when that phrase dates from, but it's relatively recent. And trying to get the stories of the veterans who are now quite elderly, those that survive. And they did not want to talk about many of the violent things that they saw because of, you know, the post-traumatic stress, which was not taken as seriously, perhaps, as it is today.
I do wonder, though, it's kind of interesting, an interesting prediction. I would almost predict the other way in that I think the nostalgia for a justifiable war is only going to increase with time because I think we're done with
justifiable wars.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, in a kind of universally accepted way. And I think that that may become a very romantic part of our past, the way the Civil War kind of has.
So now there's going to be a 1776 version of D-Day? Is that what you're predicting?
That's a great idea. I'm running off to write the screenplay.
D-Day the musical. Well, as we talk about sort of the anti-hero patriot film, Laura, you named Coming Home as one of yours.
Yes. I have a website, moviediva.com, and occasionally people write to me about various conversations. And over a period of time, I've gotten to be, I can't say a pen pal anymore, with this older gentleman who is a retired Arizona border guard, but was also a Vietnam veteran. And he wrote to me about many patriotic movies that he loved, including Casablanca, which has a fantastic scene with La Marseillaise, you know, being oversung with a, you know, German song. But he said for him, the most telling patriotic film was Coming Home, because he said all of us who wasted our time or lives in Vietnam knew exactly what Bruce Dern in this film, his dialogue meant. None of us ever came up to our John Wayne expectations of self as hero. There just wasn't a hell of a lot of honor and dignity there for those of us when we compared ourselves to the greatest generations of World War II who had always been our heroes. I'm not sure that Coming Home was a patriotic movie, but it sure told my generation's story regarding Vietnam twisting us up inside. A little of that bitter twist is still here today.
Through the ashes of our... I'm here to tell you, it's a lousy thing, man. I don't see any reason for it. And there's a lot of shit that I did over there that I find hard to live with.
And I don't want to see people like you, man, coming back and having to face the rest of your lives with that. It's simple as that. I don't feel sorry for myself. I'm a lot smarter now than when I went. And I'm just telling you, there's a choice to be made here.
And both Jane Fonda and John Voight won Academy Awards for their roles in this movie, which I had never seen until a couple of weeks ago. And it is an extraordinarily powerful statement about people who wanted to fight that John Wayne kind of war and found that Vietnam made that completely impossible.
Well, but I also think it's really interesting to think about the idea of dealing with the war veteran as part of thinking about patriotism. If you think about a film like Best Years of Our Lives that came out after World War II and that was trying to deal with...
Which is an exact equivalent to coming home
absolutely.
For a previous war.
And it's very interesting to look at those two films side by side, actually, in terms of the way that those wars resonated with the culture, but just the difficulties of reintegration. I mean, there is a certain kind of important honesty about not just dealing with the victories on the battlefield, but dealing with the consequences. And I think, I mean, certainly Jane Fonda is a controversial figure in the history of this country in dealing with wars. But this is a very intimate and disturbing kind of portrayal of the damage that is wrought by service.
On the State of Things Today, Movies on the Radio, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, Laura Boyce, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. More patriotic movies when the State of Things continues. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, Movies on the Radio, and we're talking about patriotic films, your favorites and your least favorites. We're joined by film experts Laura Boyce and Marcia Gordon. Laura is film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia, film professor at North Carolina State. And before the break, we were talking about war films and veteran films in a way, and talking about Vietnam as we ended that conversation or that part of our conversation. One of our listeners chose a film about African-American infantry unit in the Civil War. Let's listen.
My name is Jim Wyman, and I live in Durham. And one of my favorite patriotic movies is Glory, and especially the scene around the campfire before the following morning when the 54th Infantry is going to attack Fort Wagner, held by the Confederates. And three soldiers of the 54th stand up and speak about the attack the following morning.
Tomorrow, we go into battle.
All right.
So, Lordy, let me fight with the rifle in one hand and good book in the other.
Yeah.
That if I should die at the muzzle of the rifle, die on water or on land, I may know that you, blessed Jesus Almighty, are with me.
We see you.
And I have no fear. Amen.
Amen.
Oh, my Lord, 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 Lord.
And the scene moves me because, in spite of what many of the men say around the campfire, or their belief or lack of belief, they know that many of them are going to die in the battle the next day, yet they still face this inevitability bravely. And I'm well aware of the position held by many in both sides of the political spectrum that the South should have been allowed to secede, or that slavery might have been contained or economically forced to end, and hence the horrific bloodshed of the Civil War might have been avoided. In a country that guarantees freedom of speech, and in a country that, more than any other and in the history of men, is willing to examine itself, admit its faults, sins, and try to amend them, the question can and should be debated. But that debate cannot alter the fact that the men of the 54th paid with their lives and blood to end official and legal slavery in this country.
Here we go. Kind of a straight-up patriotic film, a war hero film, coming after the sort of the 40s, where we do straight-up patriotism. The thing we notice in the language of patriotic movies in the 40s and 50s is that this is for all men and everybody is free. And, of course, what we know is that wasn't true for all people, right? And then we see the anti-hero films of the 60s and 70s. And then what we do is, I think, hear the voices of those who had been excluded back in the kind of the traditional form of straight-up patriotic movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the story of race and war in this country is still being written, and it's a very vexed relationship, obviously, when, the Army was segregated, you know, we interned Japanese Americans in this country and then asked them to fight for us. And so there are all of these really complicated relationships between the way we treat people based on race and then the idea of an allegiance to a nation. And I think this film is a really interesting part of the rewriting of that and trying to understand some of that. But of course, going back to the Civil War, which is so far in the past, even though we're still dealing with the resonance of those disparities.
Well, everyone wants to see themselves reflected on the screen in all kinds of stories. And there are history. This is not a newsflash. It's often told by white men who exclude women and minorities from the overarching history of the nation. And that's why it's so important for these minority stories to be woven back into the fabric of American patriotism.
It is interesting, though, that the arc is, in terms of the artistic arc, is to first protest that you left our voices out. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of do the anti-hero film, and then you say, okay, now let's do it again, and now let's put our faces and voices in it. Then you have the just straight up patriots in your face, literally,
yeah.
Breaking your nose in your face.
Yeah, well, so this is, I believe you're referring to Rocky IV, Frank, written, directed, and starring Sylvester Stallone, the film that brought us Eye of the Tiger. This is a classic Cold War Soviet versus American film, and it's laughable in some ways, but it's actually really a pretty interesting film in other ways. And so the scene that we're going to hear, this is about this kind of Soviet boxing machine played by Dolph Lundgren, who kills Apollo Creed in the ring. Sorry for the spoiler if anyone hasn't seen this. And Rocky has to step in to avenge him. So imagine this clip. This is after the match. You know, you have the kind of steroid monster robot Soviet versus the American who has to work hard and, you know, very human. And in this clip, Rocky is draped in an American flag. His face is beating to a pulp, and this is his attempt at a rousing finale speech.
I came here tonight, and I didn't know what to expect. I seen a lot of people hating me, and I didn't know what to feel about that, so I guess I didn't like you much none either.
Я думаю, что я... Не любил их тоже.
During this fight, I seen a lot of changing.
В течение всего этого боя я понял, что многое изменилось.
The way you felt about me and the way I felt about you.
И я почувствовал, что вы тоже изменились.
In here, there were two guys killing each other. But I guess that's better... And 20 million.
То я думаю, что это лучше, чем даже 20 миллионов долларов.
So what I'm trying to say is that if I can change,
я думаю, что каждый тоже изменился.
And you can change.
Вы можете измениться.
Everybody can change. Каждый может измениться.
I mean, this is Sylvester Stallone brokering, you know, post-Cold War world peace. I mean, and it worked, right?
Say what you like about Sylvester Stallone. Mm-hmm. He is utterly sincere.
Yeah.
And I think it takes somebody who is sincere to craft a truly patriotic movie.
Yep.
Because any time your irony or skepticism seeps through, then you're already compromising your message. And Sylvester Stallone never does that.
No, and this everyman character, right? I mean, so nominally articulate, but just speaking from the heart, right, as this individual, this kind of why can't we all get along speech that is, you know, on the one hand, kind of pathetic. On the other hand, you know.
It's in America's lifeblood.
Yep, absolutely. So.
And he's the guy. I mean, he's the guy. By the way, the interpreter delivered his lines better than all I'm saying.
You're
is
just assuming.
I was really, really motivated and moved by the Russian. But isn't it true? I mean, that is a character. It's a cartoon. And yet it just was so popular. He reflected something deep in the American.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about the 80s and all the anxieties about, you know, nuclear war and destruction and what's going to happen. And, you know, here you have this voice saying from the corner, the beaten pulp corner, but a victory saying, you know what, there's a way out of this. Like, let's just all rethink this. And I mean, in a weird way, it's kind of what happened.
Well, Rocky is an underdog, and it's a very interesting way of structuring the American-Soviet conflict of America as being the underdog, you know, against the Russian bear. And so he takes that Rocky character, you know, and reflects his nation.
But he's gonna talk about reconciliation and peace from a position. He's going to be a fighter. He's going to have big rippling muscles and a tough look on his face. He cannot. That's the only way that you could actually reflect that and get away with it for a mass audience.
Right. Although he came by it naturally, whereas the Soviet machine was using steroids and all of this kind of technology. So it's also this kind of romanticization of like the American hard work ethos that's going to get us to that place, whereas all of this other kind of fabrication and artificiality is going to end up not serving.
So that's one form of patriotism, a kind of aspiration, that through our strength we can bring the world together, not have to yield, but still, you know, bring about world peace through strength. And then the other way of sort of fantasizing about your story is nostalgia. And for that, I think Forrest Gump probably takes the prize.
My name is Peggy Schaefer. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. And the favorite patriotic movie that came to mind is Forrest Gump, which I remember being very fond of for its sentimental American scenery, the terrific landscapes as he was running across country, and the wonderful way he was interjected into all those fantastic historic events.
One time a young man was staying with us, and he had him a guitar case.
Forrest, I told you not to bother this nice young man.
Oh, no, that's all right, ma'am. I was just showing him a thing or two on the guitar here.
All right, but your supper's ready if y'all want to eat.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you, ma'am. Say, man, show me that crazy little walk you just did there. Slow it down some.
You ain't nothing but a...
I like that guitar. It sounded good.
So why is a bad Southern accent patriotic? Can someone please explain this to me?
No, the connection between Sergeant York and Forrest Gump has become very clear to me. I mean, it's basically Sergeant York on hormones and not steroids.
It's on chocolate. It's Sergeant York on chocolate.
I mean, this is textbook Americana. I mean, just hitting every possible kind of sentimental note. And it's interesting because this is a film that some people either really respond to and go, wow, I love that movie. I could watch it over and over again. And other people just find it so saccharine and so preposterous.
It's like three boxes of chocolates.
You know what you're going to get.
It's just too sweet. It's just too sweet. But then the question is whether or not, because it certainly wasn't billed as a patriotic film, but when we asked, we got a number of people who named this. And I guess the patriotism here is it's a way of understanding America sort of free of politics. It's the cultural history of America. Here's who we are as Americans. We're the people who, you know, some guy can come up from the South and be a successful rock star, you know, or
I mean, in some ways, it's kind of conflating it's not even a Horatio Alger. I mean, it's like a kind of an accidental trajectory. And it's weird because the more you think about it, I mean, he's a character who has no kind of will or agency. I mean, he just stumbles. So he's unlike Rocky. He's unlike all these other characters.
But he's the blank slate that you can project yourself upon. Right. I mean, the movie that I think of with Forrest Gump is Zelig, you know, the Woody Allen film in which he, too, appears at all of these historical events. But he truly is an invisible man.
Right. Yeah, very different.
So there's the sort of the cultural history absent any kind of political conflict, and that's a nice, safe movie, and it's a good way to sort of say, well, this is what it means to be an American.
Right, and to skate through American history and, you know, the Vietnam War and all this stuff and just kind of be there. It's you know, it's a complete fantasy of what life and time and history and politics are actually like.
And Laura, getting back to this theme of pulling together, you know, having a common enemy or a common goal, is the theme that you found so important in Apollo 13, right?
Well, when I was a kid, I was just absolutely fascinated with the Mercury astronauts. And I thought I wanted to be an astronaut. The fact that nobody was asking any girls to be astronauts did not even occur to me. And then after I read the right stuff and realized how sick everybody got going up, I let go of my desire to be an astronaut. But still, the whole space program, bringing together the nation in that one, a series of moments, something that they just recreated on Mad Men with the moon landing, about how everybody had their televisions turned into the same event and watched it all together. And the only the movie that seemed to evoke that feeling the most for me was Apollo 13.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem. We have a main bus B undervolt. We've got a lot of thruster activity here, Houston.
Now?
It just went offline. Oh, there's another master alarm, Houston.
I'm checking the quad.
Christ, that was no repress valve.
Maybe it's in quad
C. We've got a computer restart.
I'm going to reconfigure the RCS.
We've got a pink
light. When these things fire, it doesn't make any sense.
We've got multiple caution and warning, Houston. We've got a reset and restart.
All right, I'm going to SDS.
Jesus. Flight, the heart rates are skyrocketing.
Econ, what's your data telling you?
O2 tank 2 not reading at all. Tank 1 is at 725 PSI and falling. Fuel cells 1 and 3 are, oh boy, what's going on here? Flight, let me get back to you.
And one of the things I did when I was looking for clips was NASA has posted a 1.5-hour summary of the actual Apollo 13 disaster, which shows you how carefully Ron Howard recreated everything, except that he says, Houston, we've had a problem. So why did they change? I thought that was a very interesting thing. But I loved seeing the reality and having it contrasted with the fiction.
Well, and I think when you think about the history of the space program, in this country, there can be nothing more nationalistic than that. I mean, this was the space race against the Soviets. It was a Cold War battle for this other world. And, you know, I think when you watch a film like Apollo 13, even though that's not obviously at the fore, it is your rooting. It's so easy to root. It's like the good guys are the guys struggling, you know, on this ship right. to make it through this journey.
Because it's nationalism, but it's also personal heroism
right.
Together at the same time.
Well, and it's the defining characteristic for Americans over and against the rest of their Western brothers and sisters and cousins. That is, we are forward-looking, future-looking people who are base our future on technology. And this
yeah.
is the thing. And so the near disaster there and then the actual Challenger disaster, I mean, these become traumatic events in the American psyche, right? Because we own the future.
Right. And I think it's much more unproblematic to root for astronauts than it is for soldiers, right? I mean, so it's kind of something that everybody can kind of get behind. Of course, you want these people who are the brave explorers of new frontiers and discovering these other worlds to survive and prosper. And so it allows for a different kind of patriotic sentiment than, you know, even a World War II film where it seems unproblematic to be rooting for the soldiers.
And also because it's a point where technology was all good. You know, we had not seen any downside to the technological revolution.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
We've had a problem.
Let's not forget 2001.
Always a pleasure. Happy Fourth. Thank you so much for
being on
the radio with your movies.
Thank you so much.
Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. So next for Movies on the Radio, we're going to talk about the film character that you would most like to be. Who is it? Who do you want to be? What film did you see that made you want to jump onto the screen and be that character? Email us, sot@wnc.org, or tweet us at #SOTMovie. And thanks for listening. You can go to our website anytime, stateofthings.org. It's a program produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Our intern is Charlie Shelton, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.